Okay, here we go with part two. This is one lecture. I just happened to break it up into two parts. And in the future, maybe I can break them up even further. I'm going to try that into maybe four parts, make it more digestible for you, easier to download, easier to work with, all that kind of stuff. But let's see how it goes. Now, we were talking about, we finished with the Roman Empire. I did forget to tell you when I explained about dictator, what the word connotation meant. I wanted to tell you, there's denotation, which is what a word literally means. So going back to what I explained about dictator, it had no negative connotation originally. Denotation is the literal meaning of a word. So ignorant, for example. Ignorant literally just means the person doesn't know. So if I don't know what you had for breakfast, I'm ignorant of that. But the connotation is what it means in day-to-day use. So if you call someone ignorant, that's actually an insult. That implies that they're stupid or things like that. So that's what the word connotation means. It's how it's used in day-to-day life versus the denotation, which is a dictionary meaning. And I'm including these things because this is part of what college is for, and especially history. You get expanded language, expanded concepts, everything like that. You build that up. And at the end of college, there should be a big, big difference. At the end of one semester, at the end of one class, there should be a big difference between how you started and how you ended. So let's proceed. Now, I mentioned the Roman Empire was overrun by the German barbarians. They took over, they swept through. As I mentioned in an in-class lecture, they destroyed everything around them. One group, as I mentioned to you, did so much needless destruction. Their very name, the Vandals, came to mean someone who destroys for no reason. Vandals, vandalism. So that's fine, and they had that's fine, we understand that. Now they are back to monarchy, and I've explained it's getting more and more toward divine right monarchy, where the person in charge has been divinely chosen by God and cannot be questioned. And I gave you a couple of examples of that. Now, here we come. We're in the 1600s, and although all of Europe is divine right monarchy, the French have probably the most extreme. This is a test term. Let's make this a test term. Louis the 14th. So Louis, and then capital XIV. So Louis, pronounced Louis, and then capital XIV, which is Roman numeral 14. Louis the 14th is the test term. For that, you need to write. Open parentheses. 1648 to 1714. Close parentheses. French king, comma. French king, comma, and most extreme example, and most extreme example of divine right monarchy, period. Okay, now, he billed himself as the sun king. That was his symbol, the sun. And he emblazoned it on his carriages, on his every single thing around him. And he was the sun king. And the idea is he's comparing himself to the source of all life on the planet. And here his radiance, his brilliance, shines down on all the people's dark and dreary lives. And his brilliance, and his statement was, his famous statement, I am the state. I am the state. Not the people, not the land, not the culture. I am the state. And he had absolute power over everyone in France. And we said, when he said jump, what did every single man, woman, and child in France say? They didn't say anything. They just jumped and waited in midair until he said they could come down. No, no, that's an exaggeration. But here, it's an exaggeration of the actual truth that he saw himself and people saw him as God's chosen ruler. And so who are you to argue with him or disagree with him for that matter even think in your own mind that he is wrong? Divine right monarchy. Now, as I said, France is an extreme example. England is probably the least toward this divine right rule. Even though it's there, they have some ideas to the contrary. And now we come to around 1700, mere 300 years ago. We've crossed thousands and thousands of years, all of government, of rule, of civilization. And now around 1700, an Englishman will produce ideas that destroy the very foundations of divine right monarchy. Now, write this down as, well, yeah, let's have the test term now. John Locke, J-O-H-N-L-O-C-K-E, J-O-H-N-L-O-C-K-E. For that you need to write, this Englishman argued that the people loan power to the government. Argued that the people loan power to the government. So it can carry out their interests. So it can carry out their interests. Comma. But ultimate power still resides with them. Period. But ultimate power still resides with them. Period. Everybody should have that. Now, why do I mention and seemingly emphasize that he's English and things like that? Firstly, you need to see at this time, England dominates the entire planet. England is so powerful, and by the way, it's really called the United Kingdom. But essentially, it's England. They have so much control, especially through their navy. England is an island, basically. Britain is an island. And they develop a very strong navy. They have the strongest navy on the planet. And it is said that the sun never set on the British Empire. At that time, the sun never set on the British Empire. Because they dominated so much of the earth, the sun was always shining on some part of it. It was said the seven seas, the seven oceans, were merely an English lake. That's how powerful their navy was. They controlled so much of the world's oceans, merely an English lake. And therefore, because they are so powerful, that anything that happens in England is going to affect the rest of the planet. And these principles are timeless, are universal. They have a saying here in America, as California goes, so goes the country. As California goes, so goes the country. Why? Because California is such a dominant state, is the biggest and most dominant state, that anything that happens there, that's going to affect the rest of the country. The rest of the country is going to follow. There's also other things we could get into about textbooks and things like that, but we needn't get into that. I'm trying to go through this stuff. I'm going through these lectures much faster than I normally would, and I'm cutting out a lot of stuff. So, England, very important, very, very significant here. And this guy, John Locke, what is he saying? He goes back throughout history, because that's where all the answers can be found, and he analyzes, how did government actually come about? You know, where what was the origin of it? Why was it created? And he says, you know what? People are born free. This is very significant. People are born free. They don't get their freedom from the government. They're not allowed to do things by the government. They are born free. And they choose to give up certain rights because they're living in a group. Because there's a saying, a very famous saying, which I'll probably bring up later in the class, your rights end where mine begin. Your rights end where mine begin. Once we live in a group, we have to make compromises in order to live together. And all these ideas are just as relevant. You know, I'm not trying to make political scientists out of you. I'm saying these things because they're important, because you need to know, okay, we have a Congress, we have this, we have that. I'll explain that soon. And you will be surrounded by people who didn't get an education and didn't know, they don't know how the Electoral College works, as you probably don't know right now, but I'll explain it to you. They will rely on you as the educated person, as the learned person. Maybe you forgot, but you had it explained to you and you understood it, and it'll be a quick refresh if you need to look it up again. But the majority of people will be relying on the minority of people who actually know this stuff, which is you, to make educated decisions for them, to explain these things to them if necessary, to do these types of things. And by the way, there's a much more important reason you're learning this. All these principles relate not only to modern times, but to your own day-to-day lives. Many of you live with other people. Your parents, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, a roommate, whatever it is. And these same principles are in play right now. Where do you draw the line? What is your relationship to each other? The same thing when we talk about the country's government, American government, and how we relate to each other as people, as citizens, is the same thing how we relate to each other in a house, in a classroom, whatever it is. Now, Locke is arguing, we voluntarily give up certain rights. When we're living with someone else, we can't blast our music as loud as possible. We can't live however we want and just eat whatever food we want and whatever it is. No, we'll decide, okay, this is your food, you paid for it, you keep that. Or, no, we'll have a communal relationship. We'll all buy stuff and then you can eat whatever you want, I can eat whatever I want. But we need to establish those types of things, those types of rules, those types of boundaries, and then live by those boundaries, because we are now in a group, even if it's a neighborhood. Coral Gables has certain rules. Kendall has certain rules. Different neighborhoods have different rules, and we have to live by that. On the beach, they have a noise ordinance at different times. You can't, at 3 a.m., be blasting music as loud as you want. So this is what it is, and people voluntarily agree to live by these rules. They accept, okay, we'll have a government so it can carry out our interests. That's why we're loaning this power to government. But it's still ultimately we are the power. We have this power. The government is not allowing us to do something. We are allowing the government to do things. We're loaning them power so it can serve us. Now think of this is something that people today don't understand properly. But think about how revolutionary it was at that time. The people are not there to serve the king. The king is there to serve the people. And Locke is saying power corrupts. This is another principle of history, which we learn. And governments tend to forget that their power is not theirs, it is loaned and derived from the people. And if government forgets this, if government starts thinking, oh, you know, we are here for ourselves, the people are here to serve us, the people have a right to change that government, even if necessary, by violent revolution. Now, think about how revolutionary these ideas are, and think about how this is not something that people are talking about at the time, but Locke is arguing this is the way it needs to be. Frankly, I think most Americans, America is supposed to be the freest country in the world. No, that's debatable. But here, people don't really see things that way. People don't see that this is the way it's meant to be. We see these ideas. I gave an example in the first part of this lecture about legalizing medical marijuana, Here, Locke would say, this is not even a question. The government doesn't, whether the government should give us permission to use recreational drugs or not, or whatever it is, the government doesn't give us permission to do things. We give the government permission to do things. That is the way it's supposed to work. But oftentimes, the further knowledge gets from its source, the more it becomes watered down and diluted. And people forget the way things are really supposed to be. Many of you have been pulled over by a police officer sometime in your life. And what happens when they pull you over? Do they say, I am sorry that I disturbed you. You're a free citizen and I'm interrupting your life. You pay my salary. You pay for this car that I pulled you over in. You paid for that. These clothes on my back, the gun I'm carrying, the bullets inside it, you paid for all of that. Here, if we were in class, if we were not for this coronavirus, I'd be pointing out this projector, this desk, this whole building, the carpets. You own all of this. You, the people, you paid for all of this. Frankly, when that cop pulls you over, he should say, you know what? You paid for this road which you're driving on. All of this belongs to you, the people. But I'm betting that's not how the cops act. Usually, and I have a low opinion of the police in this city. You know, I have a low opinion of the teachers, too. You know, I'm a teacher. I'm not bad-mouthing all teachers. But there's a lot of bad ones and cops who just have really bad attitudes. I've heard it described as scumbag sense of entitlement. That's what it is. Get a bad attitude, this, that. And I'm sure if I was in class, I'd ask, and I'm sure a number of you would be volunteering these bad experiences you've had with police. Female students tell me the cops hit on them. If they're not receptive, they give them a ticket and nasty attitude and everything like that. This is what it is. Power tends to corrupt. And we could talk about this in depth. I think that maybe not next week, but definitely we'll try some chats online. I'll set up a discussion board by next week just to post some general stuff. We'll see how it goes. You know, we'll see what you can handle and what you like and don't like. But anyway, so the police, the whatever it is, I'm saying this to you now, but I'll give you another example. I'll give you a more extreme example. Let's say economy is going bad, which it is, stock market's crashed, all these kinds of things, people losing their jobs left and right. Let's say someone you know lost their job and you say, okay, you know what? I'm gonna let you live. I've got this vacant house. You can stay there. You can bring your family there too. Go ahead. You can stay there, not just for today, but for years. You don't have to pay any rent, anything like that. That's fine. In fact, I'm even going to give you money. I'm even going to give you money every week, every month, every year. I'm going to give you money. And this will go on for years. How grateful should that person you know be to you? How much gratitude should they be filled with? And yet, very few of us are thinking, oh, yeah, Joe Biden, I'm letting him and his family stay in my house tonight. And for the foreseeable, for years at a time, I'm letting him stay there. And I'm giving him and his family money, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. How grateful should the presidents of the United States be toward us? But we tend not to see it that way, that they are our employees working for us, on our behalf, for our benefit. So, yeah, these ideas are centuries old that John Locke is proposing, but not many people realize this and see things this way. Now, what happens when the French king hears about this? He obviously doesn't want this at all, and he bans it. He bans these ideas, but this is the thing. It's very difficult to ban. Yeah, you can ban the books and things like that. Locke wrote pamphlets as well. You might be able to ban them, but how can you ban an idea? It's going to spread. There's no way to stop an idea. And in fact, what happens to society? This is another thing you see from history. When you ban something, more people want to hear about it. More people, oh, what is this thing that's forbidden to me that they don't want me hearing about? In fact, I don't know if you guys remember Two Live Crew. Uncle Luke, they banned his music here in the South Florida area. They banned him, and that made it super, super popular. He even made a song, Banned in the USA. There was a Bruce Springsteen song, super famous, Born in the USA. He made one after that, Banned in the USA. And again, that's what really shot him up to popularity. And if you guys know who Uncle Luke is, he actually ran for mayor of Miami recently. And he did pretty well. He did pretty well. Anyway. So this was revolutionary thinking. And another principle of history. We talked about it with the sneakers. We talked about it with everything. Somebody gets an idea, that's fine. People then copy it and take it to a whole new level. So John Locke and his English idea, this can be seen as version 1.0 for you computer people. It spread to France, as I said, even though it was banned, and in fact, especially because it was banned. And that becomes generation 2.0, a whole new generation of thinkers. And I'll give you some names. I'll throw some names out at you. Rousseau. R-O-U-S-S-E-A-U. Montesquieu. M as in mouse. O-N as in Nancy. T-E-S-Q-U-I-E-U. M-O-N-T-E-S-Q-U-I-E-U. These French names, boy. Diderot. D-I-D-E-R-O-T. Diderot. And there were others. By the way, if any of you watched the show Lost, maybe you binge-watched it or anything like that, you'll hear a number of these names mentioned. John Locke, Rousseau, different things like that. This is where it's from. Anyway. So, and by the way, keep in mind one of the names I just mentioned, Montesquieu. We will come back to him very quickly. So you had John Locke and his ideas. That's version 1.0. Ideas spread to France. Some time goes by, the ideas have gotten to France, and they've developed even further with this generation 3.0. These French thinkers, they took Locke's ideas even deeper and even further. The ideas spread further across the ocean to the American colonies. Now we're up to the 1760s and 70s, and there's a whole new, a third generation, 3.0, of thinkers who have taken it to an even higher level. A few of their names: Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, and so forth. If you want to see pictures of them, I know this is audio lectures, but if you want to see pictures, look in your wallets, look in your purses. You'll see pictures of all of them on your money. Not on my money. I work for Miami-Dade. You'll only see Washington's picture. But here, in 1776, again, this is version 3.0 of these ideas, they convinced enough people in the colonies that the English government, we were English colonies, 13 of them, and these founding fathers, as they became known, convinced the people the English government has become dictatorial and tyrannical. And they convinced enough of us here in the colonies to break away so that there was a revolution. Now, I said that in a very accurate way. Most revolutions don't happen because everybody says we need to have a revolution. Oftentimes, it is a minority of the people that are really hardcore committed. Usually, it breaks down as one-third don't want a revolution. They want to stay with the things the way they are. Another one-third want a revolution. And another one-third are just in the middle. They don't really have an opinion. They don't have a strong opinion either way, and they'll just go whichever way the wind blows. But the one-third who want a revolution are usually very highly committed, and they pull everybody else along. And you see these principles in everything. In the Republican Party, the Trump supporters, things like that. Even more so when Trump was running for office. Even more so in the Democratic Party, you see this. A lot of the Democrats are not extreme. I don't want to use that. That has a negative connotation. You see, connotation is used all the time. Has a negative connotation when I say extreme, but a lot of Democrats are more central, and we'll talk about the history of the Democratic Party, Republican Party, how we have political party. You'll understand all of that maybe next lecture. Next lecture, but we will definitely cover all of that. Why it's called left wing and right wing, why it's called the red states and blue states, how the political parties came about. All this you'll understand before this class semester is over. But here in the Democratic Party, you have people who have moved to the left who are outright socialists. You have Bernie Sanders. You have AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Maybe you guys haven't heard of these people, but they've become very prominent. All of a sudden in the Democratic Party, you have ideas which were seen as extreme fringe ideas, socialism and things like that. Now it's become much more mainstream. And the way these things work, whether it's a Republican Party, whether it's the Democratic Party, whether it's America as a whole, whether it's the world, whatever it is, a minority of the people within that group are really hardcore committed and pull the rest along and move the entire party or the entire country or whatever it is toward their position just because they're really, really committed. I don't know. I wish that we were in class and I could ask, who here is for that? You know, who is a so-called justice Democrat, or who is a this, who is a that? But maybe we'll get into that later in the semester. Maybe we'll do an online chat. Anyway, so this is what happened in the British colonies here in America. A minority of the people, maybe a third of them, wanted to break away from England. But they were strong. They were hardcore enough that they said, no, we are going to break away, and they pulled the colonies into revolution, into rebellion. And I have called these people founding fathers, people like George Washington and everything like that. It's important to know something I said earlier in the semester. History is written by the winners. History is written by the winners. We revere them as heroes, and we revere Benedict Arnold, who tried to betray us to the British, who tried to, you know, we don't have time to get into it. That's really for a different class, American History Part 1. But Benedict Arnold is seen as America's biggest traitor here, tried to give us over to the British. If the British had won this Revolutionary War, the American Revolution, we would remember things completely the opposite. Benedict Arnold would have been seen as a patriot, and our founding fathers would have been seen as traitors, and they would have been hanged as such. The history books would show them as these, maybe even as terrorists. That's how they would have been remembered. But we won, the American colonies won and broke away, and so this is how we see things. Now, what is this thing here? All right, I hope this cord didn't come loose and I have to redo this lecture, but anyway, let's move on. So, that's the thing here. We broke away from the British, and what happened? This is another thing that it's important for people to know. This most of these things which we enjoy, our freedoms, our country, or, you know, everything like that, this came from difficult struggle against enormous odds. You have 5 years of difficult struggle against the British. The British had the best navy in the world. We didn't have a navy. The British had an excellent army. It wasn't huge, but what they had was really, really high skilled. We didn't really have an army. We did have a militia, group of people who would get together in case there was an emergency, but we didn't have an army. And we're going up against the mightiest force on the planet, the British. Now, did we have any advantages? Well, here's one of them. It's a test term. George Washington. George. Washington. George Washington with a G. I have some students spell it with a J sometimes. No Jorge Washington. George Washington. Now, for that you need to write. The one person most responsible for the success of the American Revolution. The one person most responsible for the success of the American Revolution. Now, this is a big thing here. People, he was not a brilliant general. He was not, we don't think, a brilliant man. He was a smart man, but not brilliant. In fact, his early battles, he lost them, and he lost them quite badly. Now, mind you, Washington was not a general. You know, he's just the best we had. So we put him in charge of all our military, and this is what it is. He's leading our people, our American colonists, not professional soldiers, anything like that, against the British. And this is not an easy thing to do, especially for 5 years. You have, you know, one way to look at this is, imagine trying to feed one army, a small army, let's say 10,000, 20,000 people, one meal, just one meal. How are you going to feed 10 or 20,000 men? How many eggs does that take? How much flour does that take? How much bread, how much sugar, how much coffee? They say an army marches on its stomach. Is this extremely cold weather? You need hot food. This bread needs to be baked. You can't just give them raw dough or barley or whatever it is. This needs to be cooked. How are you going to cook it? In ovens. Hundreds of ovens pulled by thousands of mules over long distances. Maybe there are roads, maybe they're not. All the while, the enemy is shooting at you and trying to kill you. Imagine how difficult this is to do. What did we have? We had very little. We didn't have gunpowder, not enough. We didn't have uniforms. We didn't have training, knowledge of marching, tactics, strategy, all these types of things. So, what did we have? Did we have any other advantages? Well, we did. The French helped us. See, they were just, and I would love to get into this because it's really important in world history. But I'm just going to touch on it basically. But you really, people should really know these things. People in the world should really know about these important events that happened in human history. You had the British and the French have been at each other's throats for over 1,000 years. Fighting back and forth for who would be dominant. And even today, even though they made up, they really sort of have an antagonistic relationship with each other. But throughout history, they've been fighting and getting into these different wars and battles. But there is one point where they have a massive, massive war, and that will determine who dominates the planet. This is known as the Seven Years' War. That's the name of it. It is so gigantic, it really should have been called World War I, because it is the first war fought all around the world. Even here in the American colonies, we participate in it. Just this area of the war is known as the Seven Years' War, which we fight in. You may have heard of it, the Seven Years' War. But that is merely a small subset of this huge, massive war called the Seven Years' War. Here, the American colonists, which were British colonists, fought against the French and their Indian allies. That's why it's known as the French and Indian War. But really, that is only one, for you military people, that is one theater of this much larger war, the Seven Years' War. And they throw everything they've got against each other because this one is the one to decide everything. They borrow, you know, in a war, wars are very expensive and you have to borrow a lot of money. Both the British and the French borrow to the hilt. They borrow every single thing they can. Now, how did it turn out? Even though it looks like the British are going to win, that the French are going to win, excuse me, they have more population, everything like that, it is actually the British that wind up winning. And partly that's because the French are still in that divine right monarchy where the king has absolute power and he cannot be questioned. Whereas the British, they have a king, but really their decision making is being done by experts, by people who really know their stuff and everything like that. And the British wind up winning. In fact, they win everywhere. They win everything everywhere. The only thing the French kept are the things the British didn't want. So, here, the British, and I will say this, the British now have won, and they are dominating the planet after the Seven Years' War. So this is before the American Revolution. I didn't mean to go into this, but it really is important. It really, really is what some of the stuff that shaped our world and shaped our country. And you kind of really need to understand it to understand American history and America as a whole. So before the American Revolution, this gigantic war, Seven Years' War, British won everything. But even though they have all this stuff, they have India, they have the Caribbean, they have the sugar producing areas, huge, huge valuable things. They don't have cash, and they have all these debts. So they need cash to pay these debts. They need actual money. They can't pay these debts in territory that they've conquered. Well, how do governments get money? Mostly they get it from taxing their citizens. British looked around everywhere. The taxes are sky high everywhere in their empire except for one place where it's actually unusually low, and that is its American colonies. So that's why they decide all of a sudden to raise our taxes. Not much. Just a little bit, they try and raise our taxes. It's nothing. It would have been a drop in the bucket compared to what they owe. But we said, no, we don't want to pay these taxes. Taxation without representation is tyranny. We used the British own argument against them and said they are being tyrannical. And here, there are different theories as to why we broke away when really the British wanted almost nothing. A very minor thing. And as for the representation, they were working on ideas to fix this. They were working on it. Look, they said, we can't give you direct representation. You're on the other side of the world. We can't have you sending your politicians here and then having to check with the people every time they're going to make a decision. We can't do it. They have to travel all the way back from England to America and back. It'll take weeks, if not months. We have virtual representation. Here we are representing you, your best interest as well as our own. We said no. Everything, every kind of compromise the British came up with, we said no. We're breaking away. And one of the theories as to why that is when the British really didn't want that much. One of the theories was the British are going to try and get the money from the people who have the money. You can't tax the farmers and everything like that. So they put, for example, a stamp tax, because that's something you have to buy. If farmers can just go their whole lives without ever seeing or using money, stamps you have to buy. Well, who uses those stamps? Politicians, lawyers, newspaper people, all the people who have the power to shape opinion and everything. That's who the British unintentionally were taxing the most, the stamp tax, just to give you an example. And so they shaped the opinions of the country. That's one theory as to why we broke away. I mean, even now, the British are still scratching their heads on it. Why on earth did the Americans break away for such a small thing? And frankly, I've heard this very credibly argued that we should never have broken away from the British, that the world would be a much better place if we had stayed with the British. Here you see a lot of these bad things that happened in World War I. If we had been with the British, now I'm not necessarily arguing this, but I'm saying this is a very fair argument. The Kaiser in Germany, we're not there yet. This will be toward the end of the semester with World War I. Germany would never have dared to go against England if America was with England. And there wasn't a World War I, then there wouldn't have been a World War II. Hitler would never have come to power. Well, slavery. The British abolished slavery much sooner than we did. The Native Americans. The British respected the Native American territory much more than we Americans did. So it's food for thought. I mean, in high school and elementary school, certainly, you know, we kind of get the party line that, oh, America is perfect and everything worked out great and we're the heroes and everything like that. I do think, in my opinion, America is the greatest country on earth. But that's my opinion, and I know I'm biased. You know, it's okay to have that opinion as long as you know it's a biased opinion. Here, we try and look at things objectively. When we're in college, we try and see that, oh, you know what? A lot of times the bad guys win. Life isn't fair, and sometimes we're the bad guys. Anyway. So, now this brings us to the American Revolution and the French. What happened to them? They are also like the British. They borrowed very heavily and they need money to pay these debts. But unlike the British, not only did they not gain a bunch of stuff, they lost all of their good stuff. This is really bad. And again, all these principles relate today, not just to international affairs or national affairs, but to your own day-to-day lives. A number of you are going into the medical field, usually nursing, but even if you're not, a number of you might get school loans. There's a question. A number of you might plan on buying a house. Interest rates are going to probably be lower and lower, might be a thing for you to do. There, when you have a debt, or a corporation has a debt, or a business has a debt, or a country has a debt, the question is, do you have the corresponding assets? Corresponding assets, what are those? It means that if you owe $150,000, but that's because it's a mortgage for a house you just bought, and you now have keep it simple. This isn't the way a mortgage works, but basically, let's say you borrowed $150,000 for a $150,000 house. Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's not, but you have the corresponding assets. That house is worth $150,000. As opposed to somebody else who borrowed it for a vacation, and then they don't have the corresponding assets. They're really in trouble. So you owning a house, you need to be worried maybe. How are you going to make those mortgage payments? How are you going to make all these payments? But you don't have to worry nearly as much as the person who doesn't have corresponding assets and they just have a debt of $150,000. What about with school loans? If you have a lot of doctors, you know, when they get their medical degree, they come out of school $200,000 in debt. But they have corresponding assets. They're now a doctor. They have that woman is now a doctor and she can pay her tuition or her school loans. Might take her a little bit of time, but she doesn't have to worry too much. Now, if they graduated with, let's say, a history degree and they're $200,000 in debt, then that person really needs to worry. Then that person really needs to be concerned. And that's why I've been advising some of you on how to pay for college, different ways to pay for college, where really you don't have to go into debt. One of the things I talked about, what some of you may know about, is tuition remission. That's what it's called, tuition remission, where if you work for a college full time, under certain circumstances and everything, most circumstances, you get to go to school for free. Now, they might pay only for part time because they expect you working full time. They'll only pay for maybe 15 credits a year or whatever it is. It may be only in the department that you're working in, whatever, but it's a way to go to school for free. I've had a number of people, as I told some of you, who did that at UM. UM tuition is $40,000 a year, $45,000 a year, something like that. They got a job working full-time for UM. Then they're going to school for free. So, different thing. Understand that these principles apply in everything that we're learning about. And here, the French, they're really in trouble here because they don't have the corresponding assets. But they are so upset with the British, they actually loan us a huge amount of money. Huge amount of money. Just so we can break away from the British. Just, and again, these principles relate to everyday life. It's sometimes you have a bad breakup or something like that, and the person is so resentful of their ex. In a divorce, for example. Divorce, a marriage. Let's take that example. They are so resentful of the person they broke off from, they're willing to hurt themselves really badly just to hurt the other person. And divorce, you know, usually the lawyers get everything. The lawyer, all this money goes in legal fees and everything like that, and you wind up with much less than if you had just settled to begin with. The French are saying, you know what, we're going to loan the American colonists all this money just so it'll hurt the British. And remember when I said the French are deeply in debt? What happens to your interest rate when you need to borrow more money when you're already deeply in debt? The interest rate goes up. And so here, the French are really committing economic suicide by doing this. And cause and effect, everything has a reason. This is why the French Revolution occurs after our American Revolution. The French have such serious financial problems. They actually have a revolution. They've had a bunch of revolutions in their existence, but this is the French Revolution. The massive one that causes massive, massive problems and completely redoes French civilization because of money. Because they loaned us all of this money just so they can get revenge on the British. All right, now. Here, we break away from the British. That's fine. We succeed in breaking away from the British. In 1781 is the final break. Now, very long story short, because now we need to decide what kind of government we're going to have. Now that we've broken away, what are we going to have? Long story short, everybody favored a confederation. And so and I'll explain what that is, but the constitution they drew up was, and this is a test term, Articles of Confederation. Capitalize that. Articles of Confederation. CONFEDERATION. Articles of Confederation is a test term. For that, you need to write America's First Constitution. America's first constitution, it was ineffective. It was ineffective because it did not provide for a strong enough. It was ineffective because it did not provide for a strong enough central government. Or national government, let's put it that way, did not provide for a strong enough national government, period. Now, what is this briefly, very briefly? what happened is that we, and put yourselves in that position, we just broke away from someone far away, some government far away, telling us what to do and when to do it. Well, we don't now want some other, a national government, telling us what to do and when to do it. So people said, states' rights. We want to do, you do what you want in your state, we'll do what we want in our state. And that kind of government is not a federal government, it's not a federation, it's called a confederation. Confederation, the states have all the power and the federal, the national government is very weak. That's why when the South broke away from us in the American Civil War later on, they called their government a confederacy, because the states wanted all the power. So here, Articles of Confederation, this is what it is, the states got most of the power. The national government had very little power. It could ask for troops, but it could not demand them. It could ask for taxes, but it could not force people to pay. States could conduct their own foreign policies. States had their own treaties. This is ridiculous. You cannot have that. And this went on, this was a disaster. This went on year after year after year, until finally, after about 9 years, we just had to admit, you know what, this is a flop. This is a failure. We need this. We cannot fix this. We cannot tweak it and change it and everything like that. We need a whole new form of government. And they got together in a convention. And this convention was in Philadelphia. You may have heard of the Philadelphia Convention. What they did was they hammered out a brand new form of government and scrapped this Articles of Confederation, and they came up with a brand new form of government, and this was a federal government where the national government was strong and the state governments were weak. Now, what was this government? What did they actually come up with? Let's have three test terms here to show, because they created three main branches of government. First test term, write this sentence down, please. In the American government, comma, in the American government, comma, the legislative branch, capital L, E-G-I-S-L-A-T-I-V-E, legislative branch, and branch should be capitalized as well. In the American government, comma, the legislative branch is composed of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Period. It makes and writes the laws, period. The test term is legislative branch. The test term is legislative branch. Next, test term is executive branch. Write that down, executive branch. For that you need to write, enforces and executes the laws. Enforces and executes the laws. Period. Next test term. Judicial branch. Judicial branch. For that you need to write, highest. Well, actually, for that you need to write, interprets the laws, interprets the laws, and determines their constitutionality. Interprets the laws and determines their constitutionality. Let's have one more, I think. One more test term. Or no, we'll leave it. We'll leave it. I won't put I was going to put the Supreme Court. It is not a test term. I'm not going to make it a test term, but I was going to say highest federal court, final authority on what is legal. But I will not make it a test term. So that's fine. You have those three, legislative branch, and that's one of the reasons why I say underline it or highlight it or something like that, because these are not definitions of the terms. Oftentimes they are, but what it is what you need to know about the test term for this class. And sometimes the test term is within a sentence. That will happen more and more as this class progresses. So that's there. Now, what is this composed of? Let's go through these branches real quick. We have a little over 20 minutes left. Exactly 20 minutes left. Let's go through this pretty quick. Now, here, I'll leave this test term out, congressman, everything like that, or maybe you should know this. Okay, I'll put this on. This is going to be a test term. Write this down, please. Members of the Senate are known as senators. Members of the Senate are known as senators. But members of the House should be capitalized. Capital H-O-U-S-E stands for House of Representatives. So members of the Senate are known as senators, but members of the House, comma, although they are sometimes known as representatives, comma, usually they are known as congressmen. Usually they are known as congressmen. Period. And the test term is congressmen. Now, really, it should be congressmen and women. I'm just saying this really quickly for the sake of simplicity here. Now, this is maybe I should have left this off as a test term, but if you do watch the news, if you do see on TV, everything like that, even though technically, you know, I don't want to give you bad information, even though technically senators and representatives are both congressmen and women, really, when we say congressmen or congresswomen, we're talking about representatives. That's how we address them. And senators are referred to as senators. And there's a big, big difference between them, just as the Romans had between the senators and the House of Representatives. There's a huge difference in power and responsibility and respect between a senator and a representative. If anybody ever asks you, would you rather be a senator or a representative, you should say senators. And we'll get into that right now fairly quick. Now, this is, I mentioned earlier, there's one thing which we have which the Roman Republic didn't. And we copied that from someone else. That is the judicial branch. The Romans never had anything like our Supreme Court. Its actual name is Supreme Federal Court, because the states have their own Supreme Courts. Here in Florida, we have the Florida Supreme Court. There's the Georgia Supreme Court. Every state has its own Supreme Court. That's why the Supreme Court is a Supreme Federal Court. Now, I told you John Locke came up with these ideas. Proposed these ideas, everything like that. That's fine. Version 2.0, the French came up with them. And one of them was Montesquieu, who I mentioned, Baron de Montesquieu. He wrote a book called Spirit of the Laws. And in it, he analyzed the Roman Republic. He said, you know, why did the Roman Republic, it's great, it's amazing, it stood for such a long time, why did it fall apart? Well, he analyzed it and he said, you know what, it should have had something like a Supreme Court. They had courts, of course, they had judges and things like that where you could sue each other in business. They had courts where he could be tried for murder, that type of thing. But it never had a court which could determine whether something is legal or not legal in terms of constitutionality. That's why when a general marched on Rome and took it over by force, no one could say, no, you're not allowed to do this. Might made right. If they had a Supreme Court, they could have said, well, you're in power now, and we can't throw you out, but this is an illegal action. What you are doing is not valid. These laws that you are passing, they are not valid, and they need to be thrown out. So Montesquieu came up with this idea, and we, Generation 3.0, we took Montesquieu's idea and ran with it, and we created a Supreme Court, another branch of government for ourselves, the Supreme Court, which is head of the judicial branch. So very, very important. And we will talk about the Supreme Court and all the reasons why it is crucial. And frankly, what is even going on here? You know, what is going on? The importance of history. Once again, we see this. You see, when the Founding Fathers were creating this country, they said, they came up with this Articles of Confederation, didn't work out too well. But when they were redoing it, they said, we're not screwing around anymore. We're not trying to come up with some creative new thing. We need something that works, something time-tested. They looked back through history, because history has all these answers, and they said the Roman Republic. It had lasted much longer than any other. It had been much more successful. Ancient Rome, very successful, of course. So they took that. The answers are there in history. They knew about Athenian pure democracy and everything like that, but they didn't even consider that. They didn't even consider it, partly because here our population was much larger than a Greek city-state. It was also much more spread out. How are you going to come together and everybody vote on every issue? How are you going to make sure everybody's informed on every issue? It's too difficult to do. And also, the Founding Fathers didn't trust the common people. Not to that extent. They were afraid of a mobocracy. So ocracy is government, kratia, everything like that. But a mobocracy is rule by mob, rather than a democracy or an aristocracy or anything like that. You have the mob ruling everything. And whatever the people want, and they're suddenly agitated about something, or they're angry about this, or they feel that, they wanted experts who will go out there, the best people, to be voted for by the people, and then they will make the decisions. So, let us move on here. Some notes here about this. And I'm just going by the test terms, and I'm skipping some of these things because we have limited time, and I don't want to get too bogged down in this. Now, this is important. This test term is important. Write this that we're going to talk about the senators first, then we'll talk about Supreme Court, everything like that, after that. Write this down as an important test term. In 1913, comma, we passed the 17th. Write the number 1, the number 7, and then TH. Don't spell out 17th. In 1913, comma, we passed the 17th Amendment. An amendment should be capitalized. Making selection of senators based on the people's vote. In 1913, we passed the 17th Amendment, making selection of senators based on the people's vote, period. Then continue writing, they are elected for terms of 6 years. Write the number 6, don't spell it out. They are elected for terms of 6 years, period. And that's what you need. And there are two test terms there. One is 17th Amendment is a test term. The other test term is 6 years. Now remember, if we have the test, you will need to write the full thing, not six, not years, 6 years. 17th Amendment, not 17th, 17th Amendment. There's no partial credit. You will get it wrong if you don't write the full thing. So, everybody should have that. Now, this is another thing people don't understand. Again, our founding fathers did not trust the people. The Senate has such important duties, such important stuff that it has to do, that the people were not allowed to vote on the senators. They could vote on their representatives. They could vote on mayors, governors, and those people would get together, the governor and everything like that, and they would choose the senators. The people did not have a right to vote on them. Only when we amended the Constitution in 1913, we literally had to change the Constitution, and then we got a chance to vote on these senators. And look how long they're in power for. 6 years. 6 years. If you don't think 6 years is a long time, what were you doing 6 years ago? 6 years is a long time. The president is not elected for 6 years. President is elected for 4 years. And senators don't have term limits. They can run again and again and again nonstop. And there have been people there 50 years, however long they are, till they're 100 years old. There have been senators there. So, senators have tremendous, tremendous power. And what is their duty? What do they have? What does the Senate have to do? Write this down. The Senate's main duty is, quote, advise and consent, close quote. The Senate's main duty is, quote, advise and consent, close quote, to the president. Period. The test term is advise and consent. So here you've all heard of the Senate. You've all heard of senators and everything like that. But what do they do? What's going on here? This is what it is, because that's what the Senate's duty was to the Roman consuls. Remember, we base our president on the Roman consuls. We base our Senate on the Roman Senate. And what happens is anything that comes up, and why don't we have this next test term, and then I'll kind of explain all this stuff together. So write this next test term down, then I'll explain all these. Approval of at least two-thirds, write the number 2 / and the number 3, don't spell out two-thirds. Approval of at least two-thirds, open parentheses, 67, close parentheses, senators are needed to ratify, R-A-T-I-F-Y. Open parentheses, to approve and give formal sanction, close parentheses, a treaty, period. Approval of at least two-thirds, open parentheses, 67, close parentheses, senators are needed to ratify, open parentheses, to approve and give formal sanction, close parentheses, a treaty, period. So the test terms are two-third and ratify. Test terms are two-thirds and ratify. Now, what's happening here? What is all of this stuff? Senators. Firstly, how many senators does each state get? That is fixed. You see, another decision, as I said, when we're deciding how we're supposed to get along with each other, you and your roommate, or you and your classmates, or you and your teachers, or you and the school, or whatever it is, there are different boundaries, different parameters, and different ways in which things are going to work. How is it fair? How are we going to manage these things? Now, when our country was being founded, the small states said every state should be equal. The big states said no, it should be majority rules. The small state says, no, if it's majority rules, we'll always get outvoted every time. The big state said, if it's everyone equal, that's not fair. The tail is going to wag the dog. You may have heard this saying, wag the dog. The dog is supposed to wag the tail. The tail is not supposed to wag the dog. The small thing is not supposed to control the big thing. And the big states are saying, no, we can't have everyone equal. It's supposed to be a majority rule. So we compromised. And that is really seems to be the secret of any successful relationship, including government, how we're relating to each other. Compromise is the secret to a successful relationship. And they said, okay, you small states, you want everyone equal. Fine, in the Senate, we'll make everyone equal. Every state, no matter how big or how small, you each get two senators. Everybody's equal. And the big states want majority rule. In the House of Representatives, we'll get majority rule. We haven't talked about that yet, but we will. So in this, that's why in the Senate, everyone is equal. Even these really small states like Rhode Island, a tiny state, still gets two senators. These states with very little population, almost no population, Montana, Wyoming, still get two senators. But when it comes to representatives, as we'll see, there's a huge difference. These big states like California, huge amount of representatives. Okay, but this is why. Senators, every state gets equal, and we have 50 states, 50, and each state gets two senators. Therefore, there are 100 senators total. And what happens is the Senate's duty, as I said, is advise and consent to the president. When the president is going to do something, even when he's nominating positions or whatever it is, the Senate has to advise, yes, we like them, no, we don't like them, and consent. Now, when the president wants advisors, it's only 51. Only 51 people have to agree. We'll talk about that later. But when it is something like a treaty, again, the Senate has to advise and consent. Here, the standard is much higher. It's not just 51. It's not just a simple majority. It is 60. It is two-thirds of these 100 senators, which is two-thirds is 66.6. That rounds up to 67. So 67 out of 100, that is not an easy thing to get. A very difficult thing to get. Have to agree when the president wants a treaty, because treaties are serious things. These are obligations. And, you know, we should all bear this in mind. It may seem obvious, but it's not. You see, NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, maybe you guys have heard of it, maybe not. When talking about free trade in America, and that's why even though we're learning about history, we're learning about our current time right now. They made an agreement, a North American Free Trade Agreement, that the countries in North America, which is Mexico, the United States, and Canada, NAFTA here, a North American Free Trade Agreement, we three countries, we could sell products to each other without paying any special taxes. Usually you have to pay a special tax called a tariff when you want to sell in someone else's country. So if we wanted to sell in Mexico our tomatoes or whatever it is, we have to pay an additional fee for the right to sell in Mexico. Same thing with Canada, everything like that, but we made this agreement. And it worked out pretty well for the country as a whole. It was very profitable. But one of the things is a huge amount of jobs went down from America to Mexico. Because why should car companies pay American workers $50, $60 an hour, plus all these health benefits and everything like that, when we can move these jobs to Mexico and pay them $13 or $14 an hour, much less benefits, much less environmental regulation, everything like that. So a lot that cost America, rightly or wrongly, it cost America a lot of jobs and it caused a lot of controversy. That's one of the big things that Donald Trump was against. Free trade. So these things, and they outlast the president by a long, long time. Military treaties, same thing. It's something you need to be very careful about entering into. all these arrangements. And as I say, I cannot emphasize enough, I'm like a broken record here. I know we're about to end, but you really, really need to understand when we make an obligation. It's not just relevant today in government, it's relevant in our own day-to-day lives. When we make a commitment, that's a serious, no-nonsense thing. Some of you know I make my money outside of school. I don't teach for money or anything like that. And sometimes I've made money, sometimes I've lost money. One of the things I started up, there was a lease that we had, and essentially we wanted to change up to just a smaller location. The landlord said, no, you're committed to this. We are not going to move you to a smaller location. Once you make a commitment, you have to stay with that. A marriage is a serious thing. All these different things you come up with. You take out a loan, a mortgage, whatever it is. You can't just suddenly say, oh, I changed my mind. Let's wipe the whole thing out. Serious, serious things. So we'll pick up on this next lecture. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.